Now I hope to keep it a lot simpler actually today than that. Actually, if nothing else, if really nothing else, we still have an action. So, Joe, you're invited once you're out of writing books, I mean, to sort of back up, because I mean, you're in a fast-moving field, but this is sort of a slow-moving field. An action. In two dimensions, okay, it contains two parameters, and it originated actually from two sources, right? In around the 80s, there was a tremendous progress actually in the physics of disordered systems, and that is actually sort of the reflection of the second model for localization phenomena. And on the other hand, there was the Fouquet-Tsing experiment for the quantum Hall effect. And this is actually where the second term originates from. And this term, I mean, has kept us busy actually till to date. The Qs are Grassmannian variables. They are defined in the following way. They belong to the group, or to the manifold, U2n over un cross un, and one can simply think of it actually in terms of unitary matrices, and then this lambda matrix is given as a 1 minus 1 structure. One of the difficulties here is that in the end of the day, the number of field components should go to zero. And that's a very special limit. And that is actually precisely also the reason why I'm going to deviate from David's announcement, because in this limit, things are quite different than what we get used to actually in QCD, where ideas about this parameter actually were worked out to quite an extent already. Anyway, yes, that's right. What we are visualizing here is actually disorders, a disorder system. And we have electrons, two-dimensional electrons, experiencing a random static potential. All right, and this gives rise actually to an effective action for transport of this type. And further, it gives rise actually to scaling ideas in transport. So the way we think about it actually is as follows. There are bad parameters in the theory, microscopically determined, and then the quantum fluctuations, the Q theory, actually change these parameters according to this flow diagram, and where the arrows point actually in the thermodynamic limit, so in the infrared. All right, so whatever you start with, right, microscopically, the parameters. At the end of the day, you have a probability unity of ending actually in the quantum Hall effect. Okay, that is sort of the basic content of this theory. And now the effect of this parameter is you can see if you put this parameter zero, right? You basically describe a theory that goes from large values of sigma xx originally. Right, and in the limit of large length scales, you go to sigma as zero. That means you go to an insulating state. Now, this parameter, if you add that, it sort of opens up this entire harmonium, right? with periodicity, etc. Most of the no, this is really everything is in terms of conductances in measured in units of E squared over H. All right, so whatever you start out with in the beginning here, in the end of the day, right, for lesser of length scales, you end up really in the conditions for the quantum Hall effect. That means zero parallel conductance and a quantized value for sigma x y. All right, and sort of the ideas of the theory is asymptotically free. That means this is the large sigma x x is the region for where the theory is asymptotically free in two dimensions. All right, and then okay, naively one thinks then actually that the theory in the infrared limit goes actually generates a mass gap. The addition of this parameter, I mean, changes that conclusion, as and these sort of unstable fixed points represent actually massless phases in the problem, where one separates between different quantum Hall plateaus. All right, and well. No, actually, that's actually, well, I come back to that, actually. It is not obvious, actually. It is the result of a double mistake. And that is quite dramatic. So that's actually why I started this talk over here. Okay? I wanted to make sort of a list of things that happened over the years. But because of this double mistake, we have to go back to the beginning and try to understand this very same parameter again, actually, from a different, slightly different angle. Anyway, this scaling diagram, so basically in the mid-80s or so with Steve Libby and Herb Levine, we did a lot of work on this field theory, trying to understand this extra parameter that was with all the familiarities that they had with QCD. And well, the scaling diagram came out, and that was actually an important landmark in this field. Is actually sort of like the around 90, where experiments were performed in Princeton by the Dantzoui group. I mean, specifically designed actually to get insight into these critical points that. That describe actually the massless phases in between two adjacent quantum Hall plateau, and see whether this picture is actually right. And actually, around that time, the most important thing was happened actually is that indeed the rules of a quantum phase transition are accessible to the experiment, and that was not obvious at all for a long time. And actually, you can see criticality of the plateau transitions in the laboratory. All right, it is within the range of laboratory, parameters. So that's, of course, very helpful that you have some backup here by experiments, and that's certainly one thing, right, that is sort of harder to get in QCD. In fact, right, this parameter, sigma xy, or a multiple of it, actually is known under the name of theta, and the whole term and sort of things around it actually is called theta vacuum. Well, I think it's honest to say that it was a rather obscure issue in QCD, but here it is something that is related to a physical observable, namely the Hall conductance. Anyway, the one thing that worried me a lot, at least for a long time, is that, well, this is nice for a free particle theory, all right, being dominated by disorder effect. This describes the long distance fluctuations that you need and blah, blah, blah. But experiments, like the one that was performed by H3Y et al., Coulomb interactions are present, and for a long time there was actually no idea as to whether Coulomb interactions would destroy this picture somehow, replace it by a different one or not. the transition from free particles to include the Coulomb interaction is a very, very big one. And for a long time, it was actually, these experiments were necessary because for a long time it was really obscure whether this has anything to do with the true, real system of interacting electrons. All right, is this really the true mechanism for so-called delocalization, for the plateau transitions, etc.? All right, and well, we're getting ourselves more and more into trouble here, but nevertheless, here, I think an important jump in that direction was in 95. Where I did some very detailed work with Misha Baranov. And in fact, it turns out, I write this year because it is actually, for me, it was actually very important. It turns out, yes, indeed, you can add interactions to it, and you can even do detailed instanton computations on this theory. Indicating actually that the scaling diagram is unchanged, okay, for particles including the Coulomb interaction. So the fact that you can do non-perturbative calculations was actually already for me enough to sort of suspect that this extra term has a more, I mean, general significance for this problem than just some model for plateau transitions and criticality alone. So interactions and this term sort of do not conflict each other. Well, in the last few years, actually, I have been working hard on interactions, and rather than sort of, I mean, penetrating the problem from the usual decoupling regime, interactions and the strong coupling fixed points, the quantum Hall fixed points themselves, can actually be treated, and the most important thing for doing that is actually this term. So we can handle this term in strong coupling, and well, a lot of results have come out. I'm still working very hard, and basically, well, we made contact with almost everything that has been sort of discussed and worked on in the quantum and fractional Hall effect. And we can do interactions, include flux attachment transformation, so include the Saint-Simon's fields, map the whole thing into the fractional Hall effect, and talk about the physics of, I mean, X excitations, I mean, etc. All right.
Yeah. What way has this filter reproduced the space-time now?
To what extent? To what extent? Well, completely. I mean,
what do you do with interaction?
To what extent? Actually, it's a difficult question because I don't think actually that this would be there without that. All right, it was first this, and then sort of the connection with the quantum Hall effect was sort of elaborated upon. I mean, over many years. I mean, so no. I mean, the actually the only justification. So the begin now actually, the scaling diagram was guessed upon just by looking at it, looking at the action, and writing 2πi σxy0. So okay, times q of q, and I will come back to that actually at the slightly later stage, all right, indicating that this is actually kind of, well, this is a topological invariant, this term, all right, it represents formally the mapping, all right, of this group manifold onto the two-dimensional plane, and there is some formal homotopy theory result that tells you that is done by a set of integers. This is Jacobian for that mapping, all right, this thing is now, this q is an integer, what is in the exponential is an imaginary part. Right, and integers, now I mean just one step away from writing a thing like that down.
Are you saying
yes?
That the interaction, that diagram is not changed?
Yeah.
It's not
yes, remarkable, right?
That is remarkable. So the diagram is unchanged. So where the fractional effect on that diagram?
Well, you see, that's a very... that's very nice. I mean, I don't know where to start either, actually. well, but I mean, sort of, and talking in terms of cartoons, right? This is sort of, this was already recognized in 1985 or something, that this is a regime where normally in very dirty systems you never come. Somehow you calculate the bad parameters, and you always you always start out your scaling from above these fixed points. All right, that is sort of the really the that's simply it. Okay, so the idea, and a lot of speculation was done on that actually, is that, well, okay, suppose you now sort of increase the effective interactions, etc., etc. All right, you somewhere end up here, and then you start filling up this unknown area, all right, and then sort of repeating the same structure, you make some sort of similarity, and then you fill out the whole fractional effect. In fact, the first guesses in the field were already almost right. All right, the problem is only that, there is nothing universal about it, okay?
You are filling, that's a pretty complicated space in terminology, right?
Yeah.
What are you filling up?
Well, the idea is, you see, you end up where you start out with. If you start out here, you always end up with the integer quantum Hall effect. But if you start somewhere in this diagram, for some reason, all right, you have to follow the renormalization flows there. All right, and quite obviously, the renormalization flows, brings you into the fractional regime. So it's quite tempting, actually, to make pictures of this type, all right, where this is 1/3. All right, and then you keep on going on in self-similar fashion, and then sooner or less you have filled up. And actually, this type of mapping, there's already a group structure associated with this, SL2Z, which is obtained from the idea of flux attachment transformations and mapping the integer in the fractional Hall effect. And SL2Z is now being used or being sort of pushed in playing the role of the fundamental symmetry of this problem. But this becomes now a self-dual point on the SL2Z, all right? And we have a new symmetry, and you can do a lot of things with that. But that is really not true. SL2Z was actually one of the things that was on my list that I wanted to talk about. But SL2Z is not a fundamental symmetry for this critical point, all right? Why can I say that? Well, I can describe many more mappings to you which have the same effect, mapping integer and the fractional Hall effect, but they are not at all like SL2Z. All right, so there's nothing fundamental as far as the critical point is concerned about that. Yeah. No. Actually, the few people we discussed it. And like always, right, in the first instance, the first 2 hours, you're quite excited about it and think, oh my God, actually, there's a new field of research going on. And in fact, the basic idea is not bad, because the basic idea is actually come from supersymmetry. All right, unfortunately, you cannot apply these methods in this case. All right, he makes there some very, very fundamental mistakes. All right. First of all, he is not allowed to use SL2Z, but then actually he's sort of, well, I don't know, there are many, many mistakes, but one of the things is that there is indeed a duality, in supersymmetric theories, mapping weak coupling into strong coupling, all right? But actually there you have, for instance, a beta function of weak coupling, which is exactly equals zero, gives you actually a beta function of strong coupling that diverges. Now here the beta function in strong coupling is not diverging. It is, right, it represents a massive theory. And that is actually one of the fundamental reasons why it goes wrong. But SL2Z is not good to begin with, so actually the whole thing is... it happens quite often like that, okay. I don't want to burn my hands on that now. Yes, no, the replica limit. Okay, let us just start a little bit from the beginning, because I have to sort of fulfill my claim that some double mistakes were made in the understanding of this parameter. Um, quite justifiably, actually, this limit is, of course, a very worrisome thing, especially because we are talking here about all this non-perturbative stuff and claiming that actually this entire diagram comes out actually in the limit n go to zero alone. All right. It has also meaning for general n, but only with strings attached. These are not gross things, though. No. Okay, so let us start from the beginning. Okay, replica limit. All right. There are some basic rules in this game, all right, which has nothing actually to do with it. But these are fundamental things that your theory has to obey, otherwise forget about it. All right, and these things are something, are things like this. The expectation value of the Q should be equal to lambda, this lambda. And that means the quantum fluctuations should not change, actually, the classical value. All right? For this particular quantity alone. All right, and that is actually, one has to add actually a thing like something like, rho eta trace Q lambda to this theory. All right, and giving sort of like the idea of magnetization, all right, in ordinary Heisenberg ferromagnets. This plays a role of frequency in the problem. This is the density of states. All right, and in disorder systems, non-interacting particles, it is required that the density of states is not going singular. And as a result, you should have that. And that is very easy to check, all right, because spaces you can just describe, I mean, loop by loop, and you see that for quantities like this, all the quantum corrections have internal loops that go with the replica factor, so they drop out to all orders in perturbation theory. All right, and that should be non-perturbatively as well. So that's a very important thing, because that doesn't happen to any integer number. There's always in two dimensions, right? In fact, on the basis of the Mermi-Wagner Kalman theorem, the theory can't have any spontaneous symmetry breaking, right, in two or lower dimensions. So this is actually very specific to the replica limit. But it is something that should now more dramatic are the higher moments, things like the expectation value of phi alpha beta gamma delta q alpha beta bilinear forms of this type. The constant boson coupling is proportional to n. Yes. Correct. Yes. Exactly.
What happens to that point one?
Oh, yes. I'll come back to that, actually, the point. Because I'm writing down things and then I erase them again. This at the critical point, so this theory in two perceptual dimension has a critical point. And at, let's say, at TC, whatever TC is, but, I mean, at the critical point, this thing diverges with the critical exponent as a function of the system size. Well, that's even more dramatic, of course, than the previous statement, right? Rather than things go to zero, things start now diverging. And that's also a physical constraint on the theory. It sort of physically stands for the fluctuations in the local density, which are just humongous. And it went originally by the name of participation ratios and inverse participation ratios, telling that actually for localized states, quantities like this with an anti-symmetric structure for the tensor should diverge at a critical point. And in fact, in the phase value of a mass gap, so let's say at high temperatures or high sort of in the insulating phase or in the massive phase, this thing is required to diverge as a function of the mass, inverse mass in the theory as L squared. All right? L squared over the, yeah. So, all of that, of course, occurs only in the replica limit n goes to zero. It's a very, very obnoxious structure, right? I mean, it is something to be, of course, very scared of. It's something inherent to disordered systems. And in fact, there has been now quite a lot of work on this, actually, by Wegener, getting these results in a 2 plus epsilon expansion. It's all weak coupling expansions where, well, perturbation theory is well-defined. And critical indices can be discalculated, I mean, to 4-loop order, 5-loop order, whatever. Alright. And of course, stability of the theory is being checked because these fluctuations are so humongous. I mean, the question is really whether critical points survive, right? Metal insulator transistors survive because of that. I mean, so this is an, but actually, this is a very nice field in itself, of course. And indeed, it should be true that all of these sort of things should reappear at these critical points, all right? These whole lists of critical exponents, and which are, if you just generalize this, to, well, arbitrary order Qs, you go to rho to the n. I mean, you basically end up with whole families of critical exponents which are not a fractal like, at least the leading exponents. Okay, so not a fractality is something which is now sort of an industry in itself in disordered systems. But actually, once you include interactions in the problem, everything disappears. And the theory is actually much more like a conventional, a theory of conventional phase transitions, where fluctuations disappear, you get gaps in the spectrum, all right, so you're much closer actually to the original idea of the Heisenberg ferromagnet and unitary theories, basically. All right, now that's a dramatic statement. So actually, if you're worried about the replica limit, this is actually not to burn your hands on. There is another issue, which is much more serious in my mind, and that is, well, what you do once you sort of enthusiastically try to sort of do your statistical mechanic exercise, put the topological charge on the lattice, and they'll try to see that, I mean, well, there's some sort of model, I mean, that you can map things onto. That, I think, is a much more serious issue. And, in fact, well, this double mistake that I was talking about, actually, I really only discovered or something stupid enough recently, and that's actually where we have to go all the way back to the basics and actually see what this topological invariant really represents. So anyway, this is where I do some algebra now on the blackboard. It's very simple, sort of back on the envelope. But please don't get bored because, I mean, in the end, some very nice structure comes out, which is quite unexpected.
This part of the talk includes Gaussian, doesn't include
Gaussian? Well, I mean, as time permits us, I would like to say something about interactions, yet, yes, to give you a flavor. Yes, definitely. And a lot of claims, yes. No, but let us just actually, you see, because the algebra that I'm going to talk about is really simple. I mean, and I hope it doesn't look scriptic or too scriptic, because the things are really sort of, I mean, simple back of the envelope calculations. And you'll see that actually very, very quickly you go wrong, precisely, of course, with this replica limit. And all right, now it's well known that theta parameters of this kind, topological invariants, can be written as a surface term. That means, instead of a bulk term over two spatial dimensions, you can also write it actually as an edge term. And for that, you need to use this parametrization. All right. And if you use this parametrization explicitly, you can, I mean, you readily see that this thing can be written as a surface term. All right, so let us now write this thing out explicitly. And actually, very soon you discover that, I will explain, okay, so we're going to sit actually in the limit of sigma xx 0 and sigma xy 0 is m. Now, what is this limit? It is a very physical limit of the theory, of the bare theory. All right, because that represents actually indeed one of these quantum Hall plateau, but you're now sitting actually in between two adjacent lambda levels without any density of states in there. So this is a very strong coupling limit of the theory, right? As strong coupling as you possibly can have it, and still this action makes of sense. All right, for a long time I didn't know that it makes sense in this limit, but I knew that it made sense, but not to the extent that I'm going to talk to you now about it. Okay, so now this action is going to be written as a surface term, it goes like as follows. Okay. So this is the integral over the perimeter of the system. So you can now roughly see the structure, okay, what happens. Suppose you want to write this as a bulk term, then you use Stokes' theorem, then you need to have one more derivative acting on this whole thing over here with an epsilon mu nu. You pick up a derivative over here, you do the algebra, and you finally end up with a structure like that. All right? Okay. Now this is a very important structure because this structure actually allows you to make claims like... make formal connection with these formal homotopy mathematical theories. Namely, okay, once, okay, the idea for a long time was actually, well, here's what happens, all right? In order to define the theory, we put things on a sphere, all right? So we use spherical boundary conditions. Right, so the idea is, well, who the hell is interested actually in what is going on in spatial infinity? I would like to work with a theory which is well-defined. In spatial infinity, I like the Q to be equal to lambda, fixed sort of boundary conditions. All right, that means, far away, I have my metallic or fixed ground state, and I'm going to look at the theory in the interior and see what happens. Okay, so at the edge, we put Q equals to lambda. Whatever edge. The edge can be anything, right? So doesn't need. No, take a circle. Yes. All right. But in any case, yeah, this is a simple closed thing. All right, a simple one-dimensional wire that eats itself up. Now, by taking this boundary condition, the only thing that T can be. That T can only be a structure of this type, where the U's are just UN in general. UN, not SUN. Okay, because if you put this structure into this definition of Q, you see that these U's, multiply through, the lambda is basically a unit matrix for them, and you don't. I don't see them at all.
That boundary condition is imposed on you by the physics?
Yeah, that's the big problem.
Oh, that's the big problem? What
was my problem until recently, actually.
Oh.
Here's the problem. Look, it is now very easy to go further, right? You put these boundary conditions in, all right, and what comes out is basically the following thing. It is m times the dx times dx of phi relative. And what is phi relative? It is just the relative phase of the advanced and retarded blocks here. All right? And once you have this structure, it's quite, you get 2 pi I m times q of q, which is then, an integer. All right? So what's very important is that you have these special boundary conditions. Right? And you need these special boundary conditions in order to get a flow diagram like that. So you get stuck. In order to make contact with the physics of the problem, you simply impose these boundary conditions, and you get a flow diagram, and you get quantum Hall effect out, etc. But that's, of course, a little bit of a fraud. Mm-hmm. Right? So the idea was actually to just, make contact with the physics of the problem. So this is the first part of the mistake. Actually, the true problem, like Tony insisted upon, the true problem has free boundary conditions. All right, so the problem as it is given to you by hard working on free electrons in a magnetic field and around a potential, and you do all your manipulations and etc., this is the result, but actually free boundary conditions, that is really what the problem is. But free boundary conditions, you lose this quantization of Q. And it seems that at first class you lose also this scaling diagram.
Excuse me, that diagonal yes. properties of both physics, so how can it depend on the boundary conditions?
Yeah, but that's a question you'd like to answer, all right? You sweep it on the drug, you say, I would like to have this diagram, so I need these boundary conditions. It is simply that, huh?
You think you would get the bulk.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, now you're safe. You're safe in this following sense. Sorry, I'm trying to play a trick on you, but you should be safe as far as the critical point is concerned. If you have a critical point, look, what the hell does it matter which boundary conditions you have? All right, so there you're safe. However, this is motivated by the quantum Hall effect. All right, and you would like to get actually sort of. You would like to have that these fixed points. Are rigid, fundamental fixed points in the problem, right? That are also independent of the boundary conditions. They're also independent of the boundary conditions, but there you have to solve the problem proper.
Well, for example, I would expect the system supposed to have a gap in the bulk, right?
Yeah.
Whereas the boundary may or may not have a gap. The first statement should depend on what you do on the boundary. The second one.
That's correct.
Well, if you have an ordered system and you twist it, you can mark up what happens.
You may add implications.
Well, exactly. Yeah.
You can add water seeds. You can add implication walls. No, you could add maybe a. I mean, if I take just a ferromagnet and I start packing it out of the boundary conditions, then I change the structure. Now there are long-range energies there, so.
Yeah, it's quite similar, actually.
Sort of here, yes. Something similar is happening in what are loosely ordered states.
Yes. Hmm. Yes. Exactly. All right. I mean, question of boundary conditions determines to you, actually, what kind of quantization you get. You can by fudging around, by using these two twisted boundary conditions, for instance, all right, just playing games on it, you can easily have these fixed points being at half integer sigma xy. The whole thing is shifted. It doesn't has no effect on Dirac. Matter spaces, but still. The quantization. So ideas you got actually indeed to make fractional effects out of simply playing around with boundary conditions. All right. I mean, the question has really not been. Yeah.
Hard to imagine.
No, I think. Sorry, let me go one line further. Okay, then you see actually why it won't. Why it is a very special property of this particular physical system at n equals zero. All right. Again, in high energy physics, you don't have to worry about it unless you see a thing like this. What happens here? All right. So in any case, the problem has free boundary conditions now. So what does it buy for you except for some confusion? I mean, so far. Well. Look, if you have free boundary conditions, then this simply represents a one-dimensional field theory for you, which you have to solve. Right? It is given to you. I mean, you better sort of work at it. But that actually is a very simple... It is a very difficult and a very simple one. In the limit n goes to zero, it's extremely simple, but in general, it is extremely difficult. Okay, now what is it? Okay, the way to do that is actually the way to figure it out... But at least a very quick and dirty way to figure it out is actually to say, well, let me just, in order to get insight in the theory, let me just add some background fields, and maybe I can do something with that. All right? So with free boundary conditions, I mean, sort of the least I can do is just write the action, write for t times t naught, where t naught is some sort of fixed background field. And I'm now going to integrate out, at least formally, the t variable, and I'm gonna look actually what kind of an effective action I get in this t naught fixed background field. And now if I can do something with that, good. I'm very happy. Well, it's a very simple exercise. You plug this in, you get the sum of two terms, right? You get that if I call this s top of t. Then you fill this in, you get, first of all, you get the old action back. And you get a perturbation, right, because of this. And that looks as follows. A very interesting structure. it is the line integral, the trace of t naught dx t naught inverse q. Now q is just the same thing as this thing at the boundary. Okay, that's all you got. All right. So this derivative works now on this thing. All right. Okay, the next thing that you do, well, we had actually a factor of m in front of here, which is sort of important. All right, so what the next thing that you do is actually, well, this is a perturbation in your background field, right? Let's just integrate out the t now, okay, and just hang on a little bit, okay, see what you get. Well, that means your delta S top averaged, which is now a function of t naught, looks like, let me write it as m prime over 2 integral dx trace t naught dx t naught inverse lambda, where the m prime is equal to the alt m times the expectation value of the q. So I can write for that expectation value of the q lambda divided by 2n. All right. Now we are back. Actually, I should now not sort of erase this dramatic cross again, but you're back actually to the same thing. I mean, that I started out from. Because what this tells you actually is actually, well, the following. I get an effective theory by integrating over the quantum fluctuations. I get an effective theory, which I can express in my old Bayer theory, through this quantity, the average of Q lambda, which I know in the replica limit should give me lambda back as a constraint, okay? I mean, for disordered systems. I mean, all right, and that tells you that the density of states at the edge is not vanishing. So I find from the statement that m prime equals m as n goes to 0. All right? That's, of course, the limit of interest to us. But now, in general, for arbitrary field components, this is just a one-dimensional field theory. There is nothing fancy about it. All right? I'm sitting in one dimension. This thing, again, is sort of like a magnetization, right, in sort of Heisenberg-ferromagnet context. All right? And I apply the Mermer-Wagner theorem again, and I find that this thing definitely should go to 0 as n is larger than 0. All right, now what you... this opens, of course, all kind of worms, right? Because what simply does it say? I have a one-dimensional field theory. I consider this now as a parameter, all right, as a running parameter in coupling constant space. My quantum theory definitely will, at large enough length scales, produce for me an effective parameter which is 0, and only in the replica limit n goes to 0, I find that my parameter doesn't change. Now this tells you, okay, that you're sitting at a critical point. Okay, regardless of the fact whether it is a meaningful critical point or not, it is a critical point. And it turns out to be a very, very, very meaningful one, because at m goes to 0, what you can show actually is that this action describes for you the dynamics of edge excitations. In fact, I can map this theory directly onto the Carroll boson representation. The two expectation values of the two theory are just identical. So what I do now is, by just looking at the quantum fluctuations of integer topological charge, I generate a massless phase in my problem. Right at the edge. Whereas, let's say in QCD, which is represented by this, the edge excitations are always massive. I simply generate short distance correlations. So I might as well put the rope through and make a sphere out of it. All right? So here's precisely where, well, ideas borrowed from QCD screw you up. All right, it's not allowed to pull a string through your edge and contract it to a point, because you have a massless phase there.
I didn't understand why you have to assume that sigma xx there, sigma xx is 0.
No, you don't have to. It's only in order to do this calculation, all right? I mean... No, in fact, not. But this is this is just an easier problem, all right? And it's sort of a cleaner problem, because you don't have to worry about sigma xx. And still, you get a hell of a physics out of it. In fact, I mean, in the fractional Hall effect, nobody has gone beyond this statement. I mean, one-dimensional edge there. It's always gap in the middle of the system. This opens up a can of worms, clearly, because now, if you add a parameter like that, right, then actually you have to work on that, and this parameter takes you to strong coupling, and then dynamically you generate a gap, whereas you sort of have given it already a priori to you here. All right? But no, you're absolutely right. It is nothing fundamental about setting that equals 0, except for simplicity. All right. But this is a little bit dramatic, because, I mean, contemplating on this observation and elaborating and sort of carrying it further, actually you see that the problem, once you recognize this, it's very easy to make the next step. All right, first, for instance, you can say, well, what the hell does it have to do with this? It turns out, indirectly, it has a lot to do with this. Because only on the basis of these critical edge states alone, I can make a two-dimensional system, some sort of a network, and come back to this critical point again. All right, and what is it, and in the end of the day, is doing for you is actually, I just add actually an other irrelevant direction into the problem, which previously didn't exist, all right? So any problem larger than n larger than 0, I mean, I only add massive faces, but I can now make networks of edge states, make a two-dimensional problem out of it, and eventually map back into this problem again, all right? So that basically means there's another axis in the problem, percolation, all right, well recognized in quantum Hall physics, but that axis has only meaning in the replica limit n goes to 0, and if you're sitting somehow in that direction, in fact, I can sort of let me just repeat the exercise, because it's simple enough. All right, so let me now consider the following situation. And make it sort of... all right, I have now a two-dimensional situation, all right, I still put this thing equals 0, right? And I put here... the black areas represent m equals 1, this m that I put over here, and the white areas represent m equals 0. All right? So, what I think of now, the action that I write for this is the following. It is nothing but 1 over 8, the integral d2x, m of x, and then the same thing again. Trace epsilon mu nu q d mu q d mu q. So I have no sigma xx terms. I just make this thing spatially dependent. Okay, and I do it in such a way that I have theta vacua. Theta equals 2 pi here. Theta equals 0 here, etc. All right. So it looks like a trivial two-dimensional network. Now, clearly, I can just write this thing again as a surface integral, like I did before. But then the surface integral extends basically only over the contours of the black areas. All right. And then I can do my exercise again. Let's say, in order to solve the problem, let me now go in two stages. All right. The first stage is actually, well, I have a new length scale in my problem, that is this thing. Let me just integrate out all the fluctuations, okay, on the length scale of this lattice constant in the problem, and retain the very, very long wavelength. All right. Now, in the continuum approximation, this gives you immediately 1/2. That is sort of not that is not easy. But the quantum fluctuations in the meantime, they are the critical edge states now. They give rise to important contributions. And in fact, if you do the exercise, then what you see is that this problem, right, is identical in the long wavelength limit to, again, sort of like a shift in the action, and delta S top All right, which has the following structure. It is sigma xx over, let's call it as a function of n, over 8. It's basically the same structure again as we had before on the blackboard here. So let me just call it S kin of Q naught plus sigma xy n over 8 Q of Q naught. The Q naught now is again in my background field. So it's T naught inverse lambda T, representing at a very long wavelength in the limit, I mean, in the problem. So it's a very simple thing that you have to do, all right? Just do what I said, integrate out everything that happens on a link and collect what is left. And the nice thing is actually that you now generate the fluctuations. You can see roughly here in this calculation, if you have the fluctuations in Q, you get a term quadratic in this, all right? And then you see actually that because of the edge current, the coefficient is blowing up, and that you can absorb in a two-dimensional integral, right? Instead of going over the links, you can now define a two-dimensional integral, and that finally gives you this sort of sigma xx structure back. All right? Okay. Now, very interestingly enough, it's, of course, these parameters are very much of interest. Okay. In this case, you get the following results out, that sigma I, both sigmas ij and are zero for any n larger than zero, all right, by the same token, okay, because these fluctuations are zero for any integer number of field components, because basically, I mean, the edges are massive, all right, so there's no correlation in going from here to here. There's no way that you can sort of get a trivial, non-trivial field theory out. But here, this thing is actually one half as n exactly goes to zero. For sigma xy, that's easy to understand that it is one half because it is just the average of this thing, right, over plus and minuses. The fluctuations gives you actually for sigma xx also one half. All right, and that means basically that we are sitting right on the on the critical point here, right, or roughly at the critical point. So now what has happened?
What do you mean roughly? The vertical scale there is no integer meaning.
No, but this is of order one.
Order.
Yeah.
Horizontal scale is topological. But the vertical scale.
No, it's not topological. No. But, aha, yes.
What do you mean by one?
What do you mean by one?
Yeah.
It just seems that this is a last regularization on the field theory. It's a short network model, and
you recognize the flavor here, right? The chocolate network model. Yes, but no. It is much more general, unfortunately. Because I can, basically, what I can do now is I can map, well, again, elaborate. But instead of straight lines, I can now really look at the thing as a percolation network. I can now do this, for instance. They don't need to be straight lines. It can be just infinitely ramified. I do the exercise again, and I get the same result. So I can really build up a percolation network out of this. And the reason for that is actually that this thing here, that sigma xx, big and one half, is actually the quantized conductance of a one-dimensional wire. It's quantized conductance. Right? The conductivity is diverging in one dimension. But all right, so, yes. Actually, I wanted to present the argument the other way around. All right, rather than having provided a nice lattice regularization for the problem, this argument demonstrates to you that if you somehow sort of put in your topological chart in a favorite fashion on a lattice, right, you build it a new length scale in the problem, and that could screw you up. And badly, because here, for instance, this is the conclusion that you should look at, actually. Suppose you have this theory, and you're not interested in doing the partial solution, first long wavelength and then the longer, but do the whole thing, right, like a statistical mechanics machine, you would like to have the solution, and that's it. Well, this tells you, if you solve the problem that way, that you always end up with zero, with nothing. Right? Instead, if you solve the problem partially, first you do the short length scales, then you map it onto a new problem, then you generate, actually, all right, something. So, in other words, this, I mean, we have now two non-commuting things, all right? If you use the replica trick in the wrong way, well, you get a different answer. All right? And that actually is I think, the dramatic sort of underlying lesson that we learn here, that, I mean, don't go off immediately and put this thing, I mean, in right, somewhere or the other on a ladder so that you can make sense out of it, because it is very likely that you have screwed up the problem in this particular fashion. All right. And then you spend the rest of your life trying to sort of finish your statistical mechanics exercise, and in the end you end up with nothing. And that's really what is the situation in this field. So maybe there's something nice to be learned from what David pointed out to me. All right, that maybe we have to sort of be more sophisticated, go to higher dimensions, maybe add supersymmetric space type symmetry, and then sort of find the right way of regularizing the whole thing back. But I think this is really the heart of the problem. It is the right flavor of things, all right, that's going on here. All right. Actually, I would like to, I don't know whether time permits me, but I would like to sort of give you a flavor of interactions. And the importance of that is that, well, we have now actually finally a way of getting actually a little bit into the strong coupling regime. All right. Apart from states business, the one that is actually an exact aspect of the theory. It is quite laborious, but I don't want to get into that over here. But the structure of interactions, which is already an issue that has nothing to do with the quantum Hall effect, we are able actually to say something about that. So if there are no questions on this anymore.
I just want to ask you, is this phenomenon sort of often, I mean, does this generally happen in replica type problems when n finite and n equals 0 gives you complete different results? Something that often happens in replica type problems?
Well, but I mean, yes, you're definitely right. All right, but it is never so clearly visible and obvious as in this particular, I mean, example, because it's one dimension. And yes.
It's really special for these problems.
No, I think no. You can find it in many ways. I mean, many cases. All right. And no, that is basically. You see, people make a career on that. They find one tiny little example. Mm-hmm. They say, oh, the replica goes wrong, and then they go ahead with their favorite formalism and sort of end up with, I mean, right. But if you really solve for the problem and really understand it, you usually find okay, the reason why the replica doesn't work, replica trick doesn't work, and this is just one of them.
And how would this show up in supersymmetric
formalism? No, I think the problem, you see, in supersymmetry you don't see that. You sit always at n equals 0. All right. But you will pay the price there also somehow. All right. Because there also, as you go into your favorite lattice discretization, right, you destroy integrability. Well, the theory is not integrable, but I mean, right, you mix up two different problems, all right, which you have to solve simultaneously, right, and it is better to sort of see the problem separated, and then actually whether you use replicas or not is just, I mean, immaterial. All right, that is sort of at least the way I think about it. I mean, it doesn't. Maybe I'm the only one, but. Anyway, but what is important actually is this, I would like to sort of, because it's really a host of physics actually with these simple arguments, associated with these simple arguments. You look, I'm talking now about this particular line, all right? It is clear that, look, how to reach the fixed point. One way to reach a fixed point, right, is actually to sit at recoupling. But everybody knows this is asymptotically free two dimensions. It takes you enormous amount of length scales actually to reach from here to there. All right, so this is a dramatic crossover length scale associated with this direction. All right, and because your physical systems are sitting somewhere, all right, on this line, it depends what system you talk about. For instance, weak magnetic fields, you're sitting all the way up there. So give up any hope to see ever a quantum Hall effect out of a weak localized system. So there is physics associated with this axis. Now, we have another axis now, which is specific to the replica limit. And let's call it lambda. And this sort of problem, one is familiar with actually in a limit where the disorder has a very smooth, fluctuation with respect to the magnetic length in the problem. So if you have very smooth disorder, you get percolation type of ideas. But that basically means, right, there is another massless phase in the problem, percolation, And the general problem, the critical problem, is now a competition between sort of the trivial decoupling phase, the percolation phase, and the critical point. And this sort of summarizes actually all the controversy in the field. Because an arbitrary system, at least an arbitrary experimental system, is one point in this two-dimensional plane, and it just depends actually on the crossover length scales that one considers whether one reached truly the critical point or not. And actually 99% of the samples I know by now are sitting over here, and even further. All right, and the difference is that you can now calculate the crossover length scales and show that they are just quite dramatically large, in the same way as we had here the decoupling phase giving rise to enormous long length scales. So experiments of criticality are very, very tricky. You have to prepare samples that sit right here. All right? Okay. So much for that. And right. Now the importance actually in this lecture is that this happens only in n equals 0. So for instance, if you now were to solve O3, all right, that sort of people have worked hard on, all right, you miss this massless phase. You miss it because of the arguments over here. All right? And that means the whole phase structure of the theory looks different. Right, this point is then sort of the Vesemir bit and sort of okay. So we learned something, despite the fact that we can't solve the problem exactly yet. Interactions. Let me just now actually. So how much time do I have left? Is everybody tired? 10 minutes? That's quite luxurious. So let me. Why is that terribly difficult problem in the end of the day sort of manageable and doable again? I mean interactions. Well, I hope to show you in a few lines actually what to give you a flavor. But I hope again that I don't become too scriptic, because we have to sort of open up a whole new vocabulary to sort of see this simple structure again. First of all, with interactions, what one, let me use a different color. We were here dealing with Q's that are two sets of indices, or let me write down sort of plus and plus and minus here. In the first instance, but don't think in terms of the replicas, right? These are sort of labels, but what is important is a plus and a minus here, these plus minus blocks, right? So take one replica and then sort of you get an idea. So let's forget about these things, but these plus minus ones, what was here plus minus is now, you have to generalize that to a whole set of, again, replicas, if you wish, but they're called differently. There are Matsubara frequencies. So this thing goes to omega 0, omega 1, omega 2, etc., etc. And here it goes to omega minus 1, omega minus 2. So it's a whole discrete set. Instead of just having plus and minus, we have now and omega p is defined as 2 pi t p plus 1/2. All right, the fermionic Matsubara frequency. So that means that p is positive, you get simply a positive number here. When p is negative, roughly, you get a negative number here. So rather than having plus and minus, you now get this whole spectrum of Matsubara frequencies out. Now, for non-interacting problems, this is a red herring, because you can consider those as replicas, and you can put them equal to zero, and you don't make any difference. All right, but for interactions, this is the entire ballgame. For interactions, you really have to sort of work in this sort of enlarged Q space. And because you're working now in frequency space rather than in time, all right, I mean, cage transformations are sort of, the electrodynamic U1 cage invariant is sort of slightly more difficult to handle or to describe. But what we need for that is just something which I call the I matrices, which are very sort of simple things. It has a lot of indices, but it doesn't stand really for great significance. The matrices with the same indices, let's call them N1 and N2, right? N1 and N2 is just any pair out of this whole set. They can be negative and positive, and then sort of the subdivision. So these indices go over the whole spectrum, right? Over the whole spectrum of positive and negative. And what these things do for you is actually they generate simply the U1, the U1 algebra. All right, enabling you to introduce vector potentials, scalar potentials in the problem. So this is formally a delta alpha gamma delta beta gamma times delta N1 minus N2 equals M. So, I mean, it's a simple thing, but let me just sort of, the space of N1 and N2, right, if you just take an axis with mass and error frequencies, it's all discretized, then such a thing is nothing but a line like this, a diagonal like that. All right, where the M refers to the shift over here. All right? That awkward sort of type of thing we need. We now work in frequency space, and all the trouble with U1 cage invariant that we get is actually basically how to truncate the set of frequencies and preserve U1 cage invariant, which is actually a very essential problem, very essential aspect in the problem. All right, now given these definitions, we can define interactions, and it looks awfully simple, considering the amount of work that has been spent on it. And you add now an interaction part to it. So we have now done the transformation. These parts we retain, and we enlarge the Q space. All right. This thing goes from infinity to alpha and beta, and numbers still go to zero because you're working in replica space. It's scary like hell, but it works. It goes like that. A sum integral d2q, I'm working now for simplicity in Q momentum space, the trace of I gamma mq, take the commutator and take the q Fourier component out of that. I mean, this may be simpler to do it in real space. The structure is not so difficult. That's why I'm writing it down. Minus M commutator Q and some sort of an amplitude ZQ omega M. All right, so it is a bilinear form. All right, the sum, the important part of the sum, okay, there is also sum of replica, but forget about that. All right, simply says that these things are diagonal replicas. But there is a sum over M indicating simply a sum of frequencies, and that carries along with it actually a factor of temperature. Now that's basically it. That's interactions. All right. Now, what is that? Yeah, that is an amplitude. That is an amplitude that depends on the momentum Q. Oh wait a second. This is minus Q. All right. So in real space, this would be R prime, and then the Q is R minus R prime. All right. And this M also occurs over here. Now, this is the most general action, actually, of this type that has this particular feature called, this represents Coulomb interaction, believe it or not, quite an amazing thing. Despite the fact that the problem has long-range interaction, you can still map it onto a local field theory. All right, the Q, well, you have to add a cutoff in this frequency space. The Qs basically run over this space, right, with one plus ones here and minus ones over there, outside this block. And the diagonal, the algebra for the I matrices that sort of you need for getting vector scalar potentials in the problem, this extend over a much larger space. Right? Now, in the end of the day, the structure has to blow up to infinity. So this is a cutoff procedure that goes to infinity. But the reason for doing it this way is that you can handle U1 cage invariants. Right, and still talking about the limit that this set of frequencies goes to infinity. Now, in this sort of algebraic structure, I call it F algebra, but it is all the sort of the scriptic details that you need in order to make this thing work, this type of cutoff. But in this context, you can indeed show that this structure has an invariance. All right, it's called F invariance, and it simply means that the problem with long-range interactions should be invariant on a static cage transformations, no, dynamic cage transformations, global, so not spatially dependent, and physically that represents charge conservation, all right? And that is retained by the structure, and the whole renormalization behavior is actually turns out to be very simple. I purposely put here actually a general amplitude, that this Z of Q and omega can be expanded actually in small momenta frequencies. The most important one is the at first is the plus order omega plus order Q. All right. Now, usually, the problem that many people in condensed metaphysics are familiar with actually is this problem where you just replace, where you take only this amplitude Z here and forget about all the higher order frequencies and momenta in the problem. Because by naive power counting, they are irrelevant. So you get now this bilocal structure, and I can rewrite it for you if you sort of do this matrix multiplication. You can, I mean, and write it down in terms of the Qs with indices. You find that is actually the sum of two terms, right, with a fixed relation between them, and that sort of, well, is sort of for people in the field recognized as the sort of Finkelstein condition for blah blah blah. Anyway, now how does the ultraviolet structure, ultraviolet singular structure of the theory look like? Actually, if you do, if you sit in decoupling, you need only two renormalization constants in the theory. All the rest, at least to one loop order, actually doesn't renormalize. Doesn't, I mean, and that's of course a remarkable simplicity, which I do not quite understand yet. So, So perturbation theory, you don't see this theta term, and the only thing that gets quantum corrections is this sigma xx type of term and this z term, all right. And the z is important because it multiplies the temperature in the problem, all right. So all the temperature dependence is determined by the renormalization of this z. Now, if I put everything in terms of anomalous dimensions of this operator, because it's interesting, you see, this is the first time that temperature comes into the game. For free particles, there is no temperature. You can't put any conductances being temperature dependent, all right? That is sort of the face-breaking sort of context of things. So having now the temperature explicitly actually as a parameter that runs in the problem, this is certainly very important in strong coupling in this regime, because experiments are being done with finite temperatures, and we like to sort of understand what is the scaling dimension of the temperature, all right? And what I'm trying to convey to you now is actually that already in decoupling perturbation theory, you can get very, very important information about dynamical scaling, if you wish. All right, now how does it look like? You can, the point is you can write things in terms of an anomalous dimension, but let's just call it actually a critical operator, a critical exponent. All right, it is minus gamma, which is just the critical index associated with this operator. All right, and that's going to determine, okay, how the temperatures behave in the problem. So the critical index is decoupling. So this is I introduced actually a new parameter. Well, it is one over sigma, let's say sigma xx.
What critical point?
Now I'm talking now about two dimensions actually. Yeah, I'm not talking about two dimensions. Actually, I approach the theory from this point of view. Eventually, yes, but in decoupling perturbation theory, I don't see anything. All right, plateau or not. I mean, I'm just busy here. All right, trying to understand. I mean, the most. Yeah, I should have announced that actually. I'm just trying to understand actually. What interactions basically are standing for. All right, you have to start really from the beginning. You have to get the symmetries right in the problem. And once you have the symmetries right, you can actually, hopefully, if you're lucky, actually say, extrapolate your physical observables. I mean, you can put things in renormalization group, write down scaling functions, and if you're lucky, you can use everything that people have actually used for Heisenberg ferromagnet, analytic continuation, equations of state, magnetization, becoming regular and strong coupling, etc. You like to be able to do that, all right, also for this problem, all right? So you like to say something on theory about strong coupling from decoupling perturbation theory, something that has been done in the context of sigma models. All right, so again, the critical exponent as a function of 1 over x, starting basically from this V coupling limit, it starts out, the normal dimension is 0, right? And then the quantum theory sort of, I mean, there's something like that for you. And you have to compare that now, and that's actually why I draw this picture. You have to compare this with one. All right. One coming from these irrelevant operators over here that do not get any quantum fluctuations. All right. And as you approach strong coupling, that's this direction, you will see that there is some point. Now, we have, mind you, we have calculated this to two-loop order, and that's, I should sort of, well, spend at least one sentence in saying that it well, cost at least half a year or so to get it right. So it is consistent. One and two-loop, okay, are consistent actually with this sort of behavior. I mean, this point is being pushed more towards decoupling. All right, so this is one loop, basically. This is one loop, and this is two-loop. Okay, now, so there is a point in decoupling, all right, this is still the operator of lowest dimension, right, this thing over here, and it determines everything. But if you go to strong coupling, the quantum fluctuations correct this thing so dramatically that in the end of the day, these become the dominant operators in the theory. So these are, I guess, justifiably called dangerously irrelevant operators in the theory. And the crossover point, well, occurs precisely actually, all right, at the point where everything starts sort of like going mad. This basically at the quantum Hall fixed points. In any case, based on this observation, actually, we can, and I should write down our last sort of equation, which is very now becoming very simple, because how can we actually get some insight into the strong coupling problem? Well, it is actually because of this. And yeah, now I justifiably erase this. Okay, so one of the things, right, that we are familiar with is actually magnetization and spontaneous symmetry, blah, blah. The one thing that I would like to compute here is the derivative of the free energy, actually is the Grand canonical partition function, because I'm working in Grand canonical ensemble. But what does this thing represent? I differentiate the effect of log t. That basically means I look at the expectation value of this operator. All right? And, okay, that has a very beautiful structure, and that only verify actually in doing explicit work, is as follows. All right? So, classically, you put in for the Q equals to lambda. All right, you find simply an omega and the temperature, and there is a factor n, that's how the trace works out. So you get a massive error frequency of this type. Quantum fluctuations give you a quantity, right, which is only dependent on omega n. That means the whole problem, the whole free energy structure, is diagonal in omega n. And that's a very non-trivial property, which you can, of course, exploit, and which holds to two-loop order. This is certainly a non-trivial thing. Now, maybe for many of you, you see already now the structure coming out, because once you see a thing like that, right, you know that a very weak coupling, that means for very good conductors, this thing is unity. All right, and the quantum fluctuations do something with that. From the structure of this thing, this again looks like a magnetization, right? It is always the same sort of idea, like here. It looks like a sort of a magnetization. You approach a critical point and something singular is going to happen to that. But in this problem, indeed, this is actually a true order parameter. Whereas in the, that goes to zero at the critical point, all right? So at the critical point, you compute M of omega, no, sorry, getting all excited. And the analog is magnetic field here and magnetic field here, right? And this is magnetization, all right? So just like what you have in your action, in a magnetic field times the Q or times the spin, whatever, you differentiate with respect to the log H and you find H times magnetization. This is the structure. This M of omega M is now something like a magnetization as a function of a magnetic field. And, well, the physics is slightly different than in statistical mechanics. Actually, the physics, for the physics, you should do the following thing. This frequency sum goes from 0 to infinity. You have to now write this in terms of a right, a discrete sum in terms of a contour integral in order to get the finite temperature behavior of the electron gas out, and in the end you get a zero temperature part after you do that, plus a finite temperature part which doesn't contain any cutoff, right, because the sum here, all right, still has this. Well, anyway, but the structure is very simple and beautiful. It is e to the beta epsilon minus 1 times m I epsilon plus m minus I epsilon. Now, let me just actually explain to you what has happened. I mean, what stands here is really quite simple. I mean, you have a discrete sum, and you go to a contour integral, and you do that, I mean, in condensed matter physics, it's done quite often. You have a sum over positive frequencies, and the way, I mean, at finite temperature, the way to do that is actually do the contour integral, right, and add a function to it that picks out the pulse over here. Then you do the analytic continuation like that, and out you get an integral of epsilon, where the zero temperature part is taken out, and then you basically have only this structure. All right, now this plays the role of a quasi-particle density of states in the problem. It is just the average energy at finite temperatures that comes out, and this being the density of states. And this density of states you can identify as the sort of the dipole, the density of dipoles of the problem. Now you come actually very close to the ideas of Efrosin-Slofsky for having a Coulomb cap in the problem. Well, in any case, you see here why I erased all these multifractal businesses. Here we are, this is really playing the role of an ordinary order parameter in the theory, which is going to vanish at the critical point. There are no fluctuations, things are driven to zero like in ordinary critical phenomena. Alright. Next thing to do, of course, is to understand that, yeah, we are very familiar here with ordinary Heisenberg ferromagnets. We can sort of go into the strong coupling regime beyond the critical point in the symmetric phase. We expect that this function is a linear function of omega, all right, because there is no phase transition, and actually then sort of continue from there and getting information on the strong coupling side out of this problem. And then, in fact, I can tell you that I did, for this particular density of states, I made contact actually with the results of Efrosin-Slofsky. The new thing being actually that at the critical point actually it is singular, but in strong coupling it picks up actually a constant value again because of the irrelevant operators that are still floating around and that change the whole structure of the theory again. Magnetization, if you go to strong coupling, usually the magnetization is a regular function, an odd function of magnetic field, right? So if you were to fill that out over here, you see that the two terms would cancel each other, and you would generate a massive gap in the spectrum. The density of states goes to zero. So the only way to have a finite density of states back again is to take the irrelevant terms into account that do not renormalize, all right, and do the whole calculation again, and then you see that you generate actually something non-trivial in strong coupling that corresponds to strong coupling calculations done by on heuristic grounds, actually, by Efrosin-Slofsky. All right. I hope I didn't make too much a mess out of it. If there are any questions, I guess I should stop here. Thank you.